at 1:03 p.m. Today's Friday, March 16th. I think it might be around day 60, so perhaps there are only 30 days left in the session. Members present at this time, Representative George Rauscher, Representative Delana Johnson, Vice Chair Representative John Lincoln, Co-Chair Representative Andy Josephson, and myself, Representative Tarr. Please let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to conduct business, and Representative Parrish has just joined us. Thank you. Assisting us today is our recording secretary, Ms. Debbie Tillinghast, and our LIO moderator, Ben Manley. Thank you to both of you for your help today. If we could please ask folks to silence their cell phones as we get started, that would be appreciated. We have a pretty full agenda this afternoon. We have HCR 23, Protect Wildlife from Foreign Pathogens, HB 315, Confidentiality of Animal and Crop Records, and then House Bill 260, Fish and Game Licenses in Electronic Form. We plan to take public testimony on all three of them, so we will do our best to fit it all in and hope that that is what we can accomplish. We wanted to have HCR 23 and HB 315 together, because they're kind of two sides of the same story as we talk about the issues with wild sheep and goats and exposure to these foreign pathogens and our domestic production of sheep and goats. So that's why we have those both today. So the first order of business is
Madam
HCR.
Chair?
Yes, Representative.
One question before we start. Do we plan on moving any of these out of committee?
No.
Okay, thank you. That's all I need to know.
HCR 23, Protect Wildlife from Foreign Pathogens, is up first. So, Co-Chair Josephson, if you'd like to go to present the bill.
Andy Josephson, House District 17, sponsor of the HCR 23. Madam Co-Chair, I think that my presentation will be brief. What you have before you is a two-page resolution that is designed to hopefully lay out some facts and recommend that the legislature and our state departments of Natural Resources, Environmental Conservation, Fish and Game take seriously a concern that is held by a number of Alaskans with the potentiality of an outbreak of M. ovi in the wild sheep, goat, and muskox population. I think presently the greatest concern is with sheep, but it's also a concern with goats. There was some unfortunate news this week. Just a few days ago, there was a press release identifying that both sheep and goats have, in fact, shown the presence of M. ovi. The concern is that while I'm told that the meat from these animals would not pose a harm to human consumption or to humans, that there could be, and I emphasize could be, and there can be a debate about that, but that there could be, depending on the severity of the strain, there could be a die-off of populations. The history of this, just for the committee's background information, is that this has been an ongoing problem in the lower 48 in the Mountain West, and then it became topical and sort of front and center in Alaska politics through two proposals, I believe, that were brought before the Board of Game, most recently, I think, last fall. The Board of Game entertained proposals about how to segregate domestic sheep from wild sheep. It drew a lot of attention from both big game guides and hunters, but also from domestic sheep owners. And the ultimate conclusion of those Board of Game hearings, one of which was featured in the Dispatch News, I believe, last fall, is that the Board of Game did a lot of fact-finding, but that the Board of Game lacks jurisdiction over domestic animals. Those reside, I believe, with the Department of Environmental Conservation and the state veterinarian in particular. And the concern, again, though, is with the wild sheep. We know that domestic sheep can be brought to Alaska, that they can have these pathogens, and the tension arises, Madam Co-Chair, in what to do about that fact. Do we test animals? And if we do, what do we do with the results of those tests? What's the remedy, if any? I think that the resolution before the committee is, I suspect that the most contentious part of it would be at page 2, lines 6 through 8, where there's a discussion of screening, reporting, and mitigation. The rest of it, I suspect, is relatively pro forma. And I think principally what this resolution does is give us an opportunity to dialogue. It gives the House, in particular, a chance to express concern with the wild sheep population, which has been the subject of concern even without MOVI, because of, well, for example, in an article last year by Mr. Biologist Rick Sinnott, a well-known biologist, concerns with climate change and browse and declining populations in South Central. So just a little bit more background. MOVI can cause pneumonia, resulting in major die-offs. Again, I say it can. Alaska has 45,000 doll sheep, or 25% of America's population. In the lower 48, doll sheep have died off, resulting in critical loss of population. There are threats as well to goats and muskoxen, and goats were detected this week as having MOVI. It is one thing that I've had to ponder and sort of imagine in my mind's eye is how a domestic sheep at 500 or 1,000 feet elevation comes into contact with a doll sheep that seemingly would be many miles away. But I think we can find that although we don't have free-range sheep herding, that through fecal matter or other types of contact, a disease could be spread. Now, I want to confess to this committee, I was a history major. I don't study biology. Okay, I once did. I've taken a class or two. So I'm a novice. You're getting those specific comments from a novice. I would note just as another piece of fact for the committee that there are apparently about 1,500 domestic sheep. I think it's potentially noteworthy that the infected sheep were found in Unit 13, where it's believed contact or proximity may be the closest. Again, I am not a firsthand witness to that. Obviously, I've been here. But that's what's believed to have happened. And the committee should know that there is no vaccine or treatment for MOVI. And so that's what I've brought before you. There is abundant amount of information that I have in my file. I just for the committee's information, we all get a lot of emails. I entered HCR 23 in my emails, and I came up with a couple more things that have been sent to me that I've forwarded to the committee because I believe that anything that isn't absolutely offensive, and I don't typically get anything like that, should be posted on BASIS. That BASIS is the repository, it's an archive, and for future generations and current dialogue, it should reflect basically everything. With that, I'll take any questions. I know there are a number of experts on this subject or invited testimony that would like to talk about it.
Any questions for Representative Josephson? Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And through the Chair, Representative Josephson, have the farmers, the keepers of these 1,500 domestic sheep, made any official comment? Do they have any organization which represents them?
They've made, through the Chair, they've made enormous comment. Hundreds of people through groups like the Alaska Farm Bureau that we heard a presentation from. The topic at that presentation, I think just a couple weeks ago, was not this, but it was sort of everything else. But, yeah, they have a lot of concern, and the co-chair and I have paired this resolution with House Bill 315 because they are opposite sides of the same coin. And the question is, how do we reach a resolution? Because I think it's pretty clear that there needs to be one. And how do we do it with fairness to everybody and without overreaching and being excessive in whatever the mitigation might be?
Follow up?
Mm-hmm.
And through the chair, how large is the population of wild sheep in which this virus has been found?
I would have to, through the chair, I'd have to defer to the folks behind me or the department. It's going to be some fraction of 45,000. So I'm going to, if you ask me to guess, it's going to be in the few thousand, but I don't know the answer.
Thank you.
And I'll say, when we go into the invited testimony, we have, it looks like folks from the Alaska Wild Sheep Foundation that are going to be part of the invited testimony. And then in public testimony, I do see the Amy sites from the Farm Bureau's on. So we'll be able to hopefully get some more from them. But just for folks to know right now, Bruce Dale, Director of the Division of Wildlife Conservation, is also online if there are any questions for him. Representative Johnson?
Thank you. And I know we can't probably do it today, but is there a possibility of having the Fish and Game, since they're the ones that have done the testing, I mean, weigh in on, or do we have something from them?
Well, let's see here. I think isn't Division of Wildlife Conservation is who is doing that in Division of Fish and, or Department of Fish and Game, I believe,
correct.
Right?
Okay.
So I think Bruce Dale is the person that you would. Do you want to ask questions of him right now?
No, not necessarily.
Okay.
I just want to make sure that they're. I mean, they seem like they would be the ones that would have all the facts.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Sounds good. Okay, so then we will go to invited testimony, and I believe the first person is Kevin Kehoe, the president of the Alaska Wild Sheep Foundation. If you could please state your name and affiliation for the record and then provide your testimony, and possibly this is Rebecca Schwanke with, is that right?
Schwanke.
Who's the lead biologist with the Alaska Wild Sheep Foundation. So if you would, before each of you speak, just state your name and affiliation for the record, that would be wonderful. Thank you.
Certainly. Co-chairs Tar and Josephson and members of the committee, my name is Kevin Kehoe. I'm the current president of the Alaska Wild Sheep Foundation. I've lived in Alaska since 1995. I currently live on the lower hillside in Anchorage. I'm a retired Army officer, and after I left the Army in 2001, I basically became a small business owner and have just recently retired from that. Despite the title, I'm actually a volunteer. I'm an uncompensated volunteer, and so I basically dedicate my time, almost full time at this point, to actually managing the Wild Sheep Foundation here in Alaska. We're a nonprofit corporation, a 501c3. We have approximately 600 members in the Wild Sheep Foundation, about 90% or more of which are Alaskan residents. And so they're made up of resident hunters, guides and outfitters, other hunters, and general sheep enthusiasts. Our mission specifically is to the protection of Dall sheep and other wild Capernaum here in Alaska. And the other wild Capernaum, of course, consists of the Rocky Mountain goat and muskox. They're all related. They're cousins, if you will. Our current focus largely has been, as was brought up, is the fact that the prevention of the transmission of a foreign pathogen by the name of Mycoplasma ovipositae from domestic sheep and goats to the wild populations. We were tremendously distressed, obviously, by the news of Tuesday. In fact, apparently some transmission or some form at some time has apparently occurred. Really, we're here to testify in support because this directly affects our mission, obviously, and our ability to perform that mission and to achieve what our goals are. I think as was covered, 25% of all the wild sheep in North America live here in Alaska. They're commonly owned by all Alaskans. If you do the math, each one of us owns about a 13th of a sheep. There's 45,000 sheep, approximately 27,000 Rocky Mountain goats, and about 9,000 muskoxen currently. Obviously, this is a very highly desirable game species. It brings a tremendous amount of resources into the state every year with not only the internal hunters, but, you know, resident hunters, but also from non-resident hunters. We're the only state in the union currently that you can actually purchase a sheep tag across the counter. So we're tremendously unique in that fact, and you'll find numbers of people that actually live here for that very reason. These sheep, not only, if you look at their value, it's not only to people that consume them in the form of hunting or guiding, but also it's a tremendous part of the tourism in Alaska that people come here for the unique wildlife species themselves. Having said that, I'll turn it over to Rebecca Schwanke. She's our staff biologist, and she'll talk a little bit more about MOVI and some of its effects.
Thank you. Through the chair, Tara and Josephson, my name is Rebecca Schwanke. I would like to thank you up front for the opportunity to testify here today on both the House resolution and some other issues. I am a resident of Glen Ellen. I live in Game Management Unit 13, an area that I actually used to manage as a wildlife biologist for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I'm here today as a staff biologist for the Alaska Wild Sheep Foundation and an Alaskan resident hunter interested in protecting wild sheep and other public wildlife resources. I need to be clear that I have the utmost respect for my former colleagues in the Department of Fish and Game, and I do understand what it's like to have other people interested in what's going on in your sandbox. House Resolution 23 offers us a tremendous opportunity, I think, to bring attention to protecting Alaskan wildlife from foreign pathogens, viruses, parasites, infectious disease. The need for this effort has never been greater. I am here because I have a unique perspective and history with Dall Sheep and the Bighorn community in the western states. I served on the WAFWA Wild Sheep Working Group from 2007 to 2014. For those that are unaware, that's the Western Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies. As the Alaska rep, I work closely with bighorn biologists, vets, and agency reps to understand what the biggest threats and issues were affecting wildlife across the West. The number one threat and concern was foreign pathogens and respiratory disease in wild sheep populations. In 2008, as a department biologist, I helped establish the first Dall Sheep Capture and Collar Project in my management area. One of the main research goals was to establish baseline health and disease information, because we knew it wasn't a matter of if our Dall Sheep populations would ever experience large-scale respiratory disease, it was a matter of when. I would like to quickly address why this was the belief. Wild sheep populations across the West are being studied, tested, monitored now more than they ever have before, because they have experienced continued effects of pneumonia. Large-scale die-offs and residual disease is the number one ongoing threat for wild sheep populations in North America. The current reality is that we are facing the same possible outcomes in Alaska. The thought that it could never happen here is naive. The key at this time is MOVI, Mycoplasma ovipositor. This is an old world pathogen. It has been identified in domestic sheep and goats across the globe, every continent except Antarctica. While domestics often live with MOVI, showing no or limited signs of illness, wild sheep most often experience catastrophic effects when exposed. MOVI is present in Alaska. It's been identified in our domestics and now our wild sheep and goat populations. This fact makes it even more critical than ever that all disease and pathogen testing continue and expand in the state of Alaska. This resolution offers that opportunity to keep it front and foremost in front of the Alaskan public. That's all I have for now.
Okay. In summary, I'd like to express our appreciation to Representative Josephson for introducing this important legislation. It symbolizes, as Becky mentioned, it symbolizes the emphasis, if you will, on a proactive as opposed to a reactive approach, which is absolutely called for now more than ever, based on the recent news of the fact that we had four doll sheep that tested positive and then two mountain goats, you know, geographically split. But it shows the need that we need to get on top of this. You know, in my some 27 years in the military, I don't think I ever looked back once on something that was a challenge or a crisis and thought that, I wish I had acted less proactively. I wish I had acted less decisively. I began to tell people that the best way to deal with things in general in your life or your professional career is to manage for no regrets. And that's the challenge probably that faces all of us. This is the first policy statement of this type anywhere in North America. Okay? The first time that it's been dealt with this seriously at this level. And that's significantly, we refer to 19 jurisdictions. We use the term jurisdictions because this same kind of challenge faces not only states, but provinces in Canada, and then also territories in Canada. So we use the term jurisdiction. So this is the first time that somebody has stepped up and actually dealt with this. So it's very significant. So a test for a movie like this, right now, I think if there is one agreement probably on all sides of this particular issue, it's that right now we probably have more questions than we have answers. But that also to us tells us that we need to be more proactive. We've got to get them answered fast because this could easily spread. So every day it goes a little farther and a little farther, and the impact could be expanding as we're talking. So the need to team up and be proactive in working this is tremendously important in this. We could be dealing with a strain that's potentially benign, or we could be dealing with the beginning of a crisis. We honestly don't know at this point. But we appreciate the time and the opportunity to speak with you here today. Thank you very much.
I know we have some questions. First, Representative Johnson, and then Rauscher. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I have found that by the time something gets to the level of being before a legislative committee, it's probably, even though we might think it's new news as far as the testing, it's probably been, if you have people out hunting, you may have seen evidence that this was beginning somewhere. I mean, I would think. Anybody that, so without being, you know, knowing for certain, but you maybe suspect, when was the first time that you started to think maybe there was something going on? I mean, how long has this kind of been out there?
We brought it to the attention in Alaska here approximately 2.5 years ago, and that was not based, in fact, until just Tuesday. You know, I've got a pitch that says, and I spoke with some of you in previous visits here 2 weeks ago, to say that we believed our population was untouched and the need to act quickly to prevent that from a disaster from happening. So there has not been the testing that has been done, although not extensive, by Fish and Game has done a good job. They have done tests. They have done blood tests. They've done nasal swabs for this particular pathogen. And, of course, just as you indicated, any time in the fall, we've got anywhere from 3,000 to 5,000 of the best eyes in the world out there searching. So there hasn't been an indication to us that in fact, we had been infected until very recently, until the test results came back.
Follow-up, Madam Chair. So in the area, I guess, that the positive test came in, district or management unit 13, and I guess down by the Kenai somewhere, I'm not exactly sure. I recognize you may not have all this right off the cuff. I imagine we might have somebody that does, but how many sheep are generally in those two different areas, and how much is that where you have guided or other sheep hunts? I mean, where is this right in the areas that you were thinking that where we do have our sheep hunting happening at?
Through the chair to Representative Johnson, this particular area in the Boulder Creek area is a very popular area because it's next to the road system, so it's accessible, easy terrain. So it is a popular area. I don't think I can answer all of your statistical answers or your questions on the number of people, but it's a it is along the road system, so the area is a popular viewing area. It's a popular hunting area, and it also sits right on the border to an adjacent range. One of our challenges is that the sheep ranges in Alaska, many of the southern ones, are contiguous. So the Chugach Range to the Talkeetna Range, potentially to the Wrangells. So the chance of spreading, largely by quite often young males, sometimes females, but young males in their traveling, is what concerns us. But I'm not sure if that answered your question. Becky, do you have anything?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, the area where the four positive adult sheep samples were reported in Boulder Creek is a central portion of the Talkeetna Mountain Range. Mm-hmm. The Talkeetna Mountain Range is split between GMU 13A and 14A. Mm-hmm. Within the 13A portion, there are approximately 1,000 to 2,000 sheep. If you go west of the border into 14A, there's very likely another 1,000 to 2,000. So there could be as many as 4,000 sheep within that specific mountain block. So that's a very large chunk of Dall sheep within the state of Alaska. And I'll add a little bit as to what Kevin indicated. This is an area that, as an area management biologist in the past, I have had concerns that we may have some sort of pathogen load from domestics from years ago. As the Glen Highway was put through that area, it runs right through the middle of a really narrow spot between the Chugach Range and the Talkeetnas. And there were a lot of homesteaders in the area. They had sheep, they had goats. There was a lot of market hunting that happened back in that time period to feed people that were building the road. And a lot of sheep were harvested very close. And it would not surprise me if goats were used as pack animals at that time. So in the past, we have felt that that would have been a spot, both the Talkeetna Range and the Chugach Range, where we may have had some pathogen transfer in years past. We have not seen any large-scale die-offs in the Talkeetna Mountains to date. And the survey rotation in that area, I can speak to just as a past manager of the area, the Glen Ellen Area Management staff is responsible for very large section of sheep range in the south central area of the state. So Talkeetna Mountains, a large section of the Chugach Mountains, the South Alaska Range, almost all the Wrangell Mountains. So it's a huge area, and so surveys get rotated. So every 2 to 3 years, areas are surveyed. Unfortunately, the Talkeetna Mountains haven't been surveyed since 2015. So it's been three solid years since there's been any significant sheep surveys, and Director Dale may want to add information that I'm unaware of, but it's my understanding that's the last survey time. Obviously, there's been hunters in there, and harvest numbers have kept up, but there's certainly a very important reason right now to go and look at those populations to try to get a handle on it. The positive goat samples were from a capture operation that were in 15C within the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge. It's my understanding that those animals are radio collared and they are tracked currently, and they have not seen any unexpected die-offs or mortality in that population to date. And I'm not sure how many goats are in that general area, but I would venture a guess, given the continuous nature of the range on the Kenai, that there could be a couple thousand goats there.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My understanding is, well, I have to confess, I don't know a lot about sheep migration, but more about moose, because that was what we hunted for. But so do the sheep migrate a distance, or do they migrate by elevation? I mean, how exactly would you see these, you know, how would you see the herds kind of intermingling? I mean, if you would just kind of talk about that a little bit.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Johnson, sheep are not a migratory big game species in Alaska, so they're fairly sedentary. Unfortunately, we see on a regular basis young males in particular on long forays. Mm-hmm. And in our area, we have documented, I've lived in the Copper River Basin for 17 years, and I have a long list of documentations of forays of mountain goats as well as doll sheep. The latest was a doll sheep that showed up on the Gulkana River in the middle of the Copper River Basin about 2 years ago on a little tiny little clay bluff that it found in the middle of the boreal forest. And we looked at where it could have come from, and it was roughly 45 miles from the nearest known sheep range. So there are forays. It is a big issue with wild sheep populations and mountain goat populations nationwide. So it's hard to document, but it does happen.
All right. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. I think we'll go through the questions for this testifiers, and then we have that was it for invited testimony, so then we can ask Mr. Dale for any additional questions. So I have Representative Rauscher, then Lincoln, then Parrish, then Drummond. Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the Chair, I just think that it's probably fair that I declare a conflict of interest, but I also don't think it is. But I need to actually declare it. Most of the invited testimony is aware because I've talked to them in my office privately or in discussion on the phone or that I do hunt sheep, but I also raise goats, okay? And I have gone up in the hills with goats and to hunt sheep, okay? Now, many years ago, I think it was about 6 or 7 years ago, sheep and goats were determined to have been a problem, and goats weren't allowed to pack to hunt sheep anymore, and we had to stop doing that. Okay, so, and I've kind of been involved in this argument from afar as a public figure, not as a public figure as a legislator, but as just a public person in. So I guess what I'm having to say here is I'm on both sides of the coin. Mm-hmm. So I'm not really declaring favoritism here, but I do have to declare that I understand the need for everybody who raises domestic animals. I understand the need for those who hunt sheep, and I understand those who have in the past been able to hunt dull sheep with pack goats before and pack animals now. So I just want you to know that I had to declare that because most of you know that. And I just wanted to get that on the table before we even get going.
So thank you. That was more like an honesty submission because we don't have to declare a conflict for committee, but if you do want to declare that conflict on the floor, if this goes to a floor vote, then you can bring it up. But we can come to you for questions then, too, because now we know you have more personal experience in this area. Representative Lincoln.
I had two questions. The first is, so the M. mobile is only transmitted from, like, direct contact, right? The, like, mouth-to-mouth contact?
Through the chair, Representative Lincoln, as far as we know, this is an airborne pathogen. It cannot live long outside of a host species. It does require host material to live for a very long period of time. So, yes, it can be transmitted aerially, but it's a close proximity thing. When an animal is carrying it, when it can be detected in the nasal cavity, they generally, the thought is it's not transmitted a significant distance. If the animal does end up with an infection and an actual illness, at that point, if they start coughing or they have nasal discharge, now all of a sudden we have a longer distance where we are concerned about aerial transmission.
Is it follow-up? Mm-hmm. And is there much opportunity for transmission between sheep and goats, or are they pretty much keep to themselves being different species, or do they ever?
That's a great question, through the chair, Representative Lincoln. During aerial sheep and goat surveys, I have observed dull sheep and mountain goats in the same groups. So, yes, those two can come nose-to-nose contact in areas where they overlap in range.
Okay. And then another question. Mm-hmm. So a new question. So the press release that the Wild Sheep Foundation put out. I don't see a date on it, but it must have been this week. So you offered to fund a project of the $600,000 for testing and maybe replacing some infected animals. Could you just elaborate on that project a little bit? Like, I mean, what would the scope of that project be?
Through the chair, Representative Lincoln, what we've said, what it became obvious to us is this is a particularly unique solution. It's tailored toward Alaska. In the lower 48, they preach separation as a distance. But I think, as people will point out, you're dealing with herds that do grazing up in the mountains. We don't typically have that. So this is a unique situation when we decided to try an approach called Disimovi-free. And so we had to go back to our technical experts and make sure that we had our science correct, and we worked literally on a daily basis with checking facts and making sure that we have a complete basis to be able to come up with a solution. So we decided that the best way to prevent, to allow both industries, if you will, or both hunting and guiding and outfitting for sheep and a domestic population, was to go Imovie-free. Because if we were to try and do something with separation, if you use the 4A ranges that Becky covered, 45 miles or something, and probably wouldn't be that, we originally said 15 miles, you'd virtually have to eliminate the entire industry of domestic sheep and goats if you were to go 15 miles away from that. So we said, let's try and do this Imovie-free. Can we technically do it? So what we offered to do is pay if people would come forward and have their animals tested, that we would pay for the vet visit and then the testing. The testing's about $50 a pop. The particular sequence that it is it's three nasal swabs about 2 to 3 weeks apart, and also a serology test. And we would pay for that processing at a laboratory at Washington State called Waddle. We even cut a preferred vendor deal with them to see if we could get a better deal to be able to facilitate this process. We're beginning to line up vets that would work with us so that they could actually go out and do the testing on their herds, submit the samples to Waddle. Then they would bill us, including for the shipping. So make it as seamless as possible, if you will, in a normal business-like fashion. So then the vet would be able to tell them the results. We would also have access, so we'd pay for it. We'd have access to the results of those particular animals that had been tested and found positive. At the point where the animals tested positive for the presence of Imovie, then the only known solution right now is either to mitigate the animal in the form of actually destroying the animal, potentially quarantining it. So for a solution that maybe somebody had a unique pet and it was in their backyard and you could prove that basically it could remain in a quarantine situation and live out its days, then we would allow them to be able to do that as long as an agency had the right to come inspect to make sure that it stayed on site. And the other way, we even said if it was an animal that you couldn't do the other first two and didn't want because it was a pet or an animal that was special to you, that we'd actually pay for the transporting of that animal to another location, preferably a non-sheep jurisdiction, so you can send it to Kansas and it's not going to affect them at all if you got a relative down there or whatever. If it's an animal that means something to you, you could do that. So we tried to be as sensitive, but we said we'd pick up the fee for that. Now, realizing that we're the Alaska Wild Sheep Foundation, we also have a reach back, a corporate reach back to the national, the Wild Sheep Foundation. And so when we originally proposed that, they instantaneously questioned our sanity when we offered to pay for this because, you know, this money comes from volunteer hours like mine and everybody else is how we raise the money, or donors. And so that's where the money comes from. And then we said 25% of all the wild sheep in North America, $500,000. And a lot of our members are actually good businessmen. It's an expensive sport if you travel the world to do it. And so they're usually pretty successful. And most of them stood up and said, perfect, cheap, good deal. So that's where we're coming from. That's what our pledge is, and we're backed by our corporate. Things always cost more than you anticipated, but I did the estimates myself. I'm a financial manager in a past life, and so that's where the number came from, and that's what we stand behind. But there has to be testing, mitigation, so there's some stipulations. It's not just free testing. It's testing, mitigation. We've got to actually come out with a solution, not just, discover a problem.
follow up?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the resolution, I think it's a really positive and good resolution, but it's also kind of vague. You know, I mean, but is it your expectation that if this resolution were to pass and we'd provide this direction to administration that, I mean, your proposed program would be, you know, adopted or supported, or is that, I mean, how closely, you know, associated are, you know, is your proposal with the resolution in your mind?
Through the chair, Representative Lincoln, in our minds, it's designed to be a little bit separate. So in other words, this is not an automatic that if you sign this resolution, you go right to the solution I'm proposing. So we're taking a specific situation and we're testing a general resolution. It was written, I don't say vague, but in a general sense, because there are other pathogens. There's things like winter tick. There's a whole host of things, and as was pointed out, that changing climates, there's different pathogens that are now coming that are potentially affecting Alaska or could affect Alaska, and so we wanted to do a broad brush approach that would be able to potentially energize all of those different efforts. At the same time, it would lay what we thought was simply a foundation. So it wouldn't be specific, but it would lay a foundation for us to build off of, continue to speak with domestic, but in maybe a year or so, we'd get to the more specific legislation that might be required, depending on where the path leads us, to be able to actually implement the specific solution that I was highlighting.
Next, we have Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For context, I studied biology, and this one really frightens me. This is very troubling. Anytime you have a pathogen introduced to a wild population for the first time, it's impossible to know just how devastating it'll be. It's impossible to know if, you know, a generation of sheep down the line or, you know, a few hundred generation, thousands, tens of thousands of generations of bacteria, if you won't have a few mutations that suddenly make it a high mortality disease. It's profoundly concerning, and my impulse would be to seriously think about extirpation, you know, the elimination of some of these populations. And that's, I recognize that won't receive terribly broad support because it's an extremely cautious measure. But when you consider that if it becomes endemic, or rather if it becomes pandemic in the sheep and goat populations in that region, it could extend further into other populations statewide. It could ultimately get into the muskox population, and we don't know what it's going to do to them. I'm looking at an article on my tablet here from the Journal of Animal Ecology, cited 19 times, which is significant, that says that it's associated with long-term declines in wild sheep populations. There's the possibility that we're seeing the beginning of the end for Alaska's wild sheep, and we don't know about the goats or the musk
oxen.
Yes, thank you. Musk consonant clusters. I don't love them. So I commend you for your willingness to commit this considerable sum, and I wonder what another thing the article points out is that once the disease has become established in a population, it's extremely hard to eliminate, and that outbreaks happen in about 60% of years. Disease events happen in about 60% of years, so that there's nothing killing them off en masse this year doesn't mean that there won't be a mass die-off starting next year. Representative Lincoln, to your comment about the transmission, if it's mouth-to-mouth, all that would be necessary would be common browse You know, if a goat comes in, could have been Representative Rauscher's goat.
I'm serious.
Pardon, Rep. Rauscher.
There's some things that have been said just now that are not completely accurate, but I don't want to cut you off because we'll go to Mr. Dale for questions. But do you have a question for these particular testifiers?
Sure.
Okay.
What would it take to make you feel confident about the long-term health of the sheep populations?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, that's a fantastic question. A time machine is the only solution right now that would make me feel comfortable with what we're learning. I would like to kind of expand on a couple of your comments. I think your foresight is very well focused, and the particular pathogen that we're dealing with here, MOV, is particularly frightening because it has evolved significantly over time. There are at least 60 known different strains of the pathogen. We know that some are more virulent than others. Some are more deadly to populations than others. We know that the interaction between different strains of MOV and different wild sheep react differently. The vast majority of times when MOV has been documented to have entered, been exposed to a wild sheep population, and almost all the science right now is with bighorn sheep, populations experience some form of significant respiratory disease and population die-offs. I have a couple examples that I'm going to share really quick with you. Washington State University is watching this pathogen and its existence in bighorn populations really closely. Of 42 bighorn populations that they are watching that are pneumonic, meaning they have regular cases of pneumonia that come up year after year after year. Sometimes it's adult mortality. Sometimes it's lamb mortality. Sometimes it's delayed mortality. It's a very frustrating experience to have a pneumonic complex in a population. 42 of 42 are positive for MOV. Of the 35 healthy, non-pneumonic bighorn populations that they're monitoring, only four have tested positive for MOV. So the concept behind this pathogen, why it is so different than any other respiratory bacteria out there that affects wild sheep and other sub-family Caprinae species, is because it affects the immune system. It acts very differently than any other respiratory pathogen that's out there. It compromises the immune system. It makes them susceptible to a lot of other respiratory pathogens. Once infected with MOV, populations generally have negative impacts. If they don't, it doesn't mean they aren't going to in the future. The pathogen could either evolve, or if another strain of MOV comes in, the current body of research says that those animals will entirely likely have a negative response to it. So once a pathogen is in the population, as you said, it's virtually impossible, if not impossible, to get rid of it in a wildlife population. So in the western states, they've dealt with this now for well over a decade. There's been a lot of very, very difficult political decisions that have been made in those states. And the most successful management action is to test and cull. If it's positive for MOV, it gets removed from the population. Test and cull. And it's happening in most of our western bighorn states right now. It's very emotional. It's very controversial. It is something that will very likely be discussed in the state of Alaska now for the next forever. I don't see it going away.
If I could add to that, just so what you painted was the worst case scenario, and that is not knowing enough now, but the worst case is we'd have to make a tough decision to basically eliminate a certain population if we thought it was infected and based on the testing was warranted. That's why we're pushing for more testing, more study of the wild population as soon as we possibly can to help determine that. And then it would be, quite frankly, it would be up to organizations like ours with all of the most interested people to go out to them and explain that is, in fact, the best solution, because many of the people that around us would be the ones raising their hand. When they put down bighorns in proximity to domestic sheep in Colorado, which happened this year with three or four rams, we've had mountain goats that came into Palmer, Alaska, and unfortunately was transported back to the mountain, and probably should have been destroyed because of the potential of contact, and that was a simple error, you know, and it happens in any organization. And so, but that's what you get the word out. So that's what we're saying. If the wild animals, which is how it gets transmitted, come down in proximity, we have to play it safe. We have to make the assumption until we know more, and we have to basically eliminate those animals as we can and then continue the study. So we've got to take some precautionary actions, maybe more than we would like without knowing, but we will have to make decisions with imperfect information. That's just the name of the game.
Follow up, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions. One is, how much does it cost in these other states to test and cull, as you were saying? And the other was, what component of my remarks, if any, did you find inaccurate?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, I don't have budget figures for you. I can tell you from what I know about most of the Western bighorn populations, they are road system accessible, so there are a lot of opportunities for staff biologists in Western states to drive very close to these areas. They, too, like us, have to charter a helicopter and net gun these animals generally, so anytime you get in a helicopter, we're talking thousands of dollars, and sometimes you can easily go through $10,000 a day and only capture a handful of animals. It's not cheap. It's not easy to do. So I wish I could tell you, but different areas have different levels of monitoring. And if you can catch it quickly, and in those areas where MOV first started being detected, were in areas where animals were presenting with illness. Hunters or biologists saw animals that were clinically ill. So that was where they first said, we need to go look at the population and test. And it took a long time for some of those states to come around to the decision that, yes, indeed, we do actually have to cull these animals out of the population. It's brutal. It's a hard thing to do, especially when they test positive, but they still look healthy. But it is being done in a lot of areas. And if you can do it quickly, then one or two animals at a time is not as big of a deal. A few populations have been extirpated on purpose by state agencies because they had no choice. They were such small populations where they were all infected. I honestly didn't find any specific inaccuracies with what you stated. I think there are a lot of different scenarios out there. There are a lot of different populations that have experienced pneumonic die-offs. A lot of different pathogens have been reported. Different percentages had MOV. So there are a lot of different numbers that can be thrown out, but it's an ongoing concern for most of these populations with MOV that once a die-off occurs, generally 5 to 20% of the animals in the population remain with the pathogen and become carriers, which is brutal. If you don't get them all, sometimes they become carriers and the populations never recover.
Thank you.
And Representative Parrish, I was referring to two things specifically that I want to ask Mr. Dale to respond to, and it's the fact that just having the bacteria itself is not, it does not mean that the animal is going to get sick, and so I just want that to be clear. And then in terms of what was just found, information I've received says that the strain detected has not been tied to the genetic strain found in domestic animals. So those are the two things that I was referring to, but I want to ask Mr. Dale because that's where the testing and the press release and everything came from. So that's what I was referring to. Next, we have Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I looked at the HCR, at the bill itself, and I just noticed that I signed on as a co-sponsor, and I looked it up, and I signed on the day that Representative Josephson introduced it. And I can't say what led me to do that, other than I started out my college career at Cornell University as a pre-veterinary student in 1969, when the, sorry, old white guys in the veterinary school who were my counselors or faculty advisors didn't want women in the business. But anyway, I ended up as a graphic designer. That's another whole story. But Ms. Schwanke,
yes.
You said, you talked to us about the construction of the Glen Highway and market hunting of, I assume, the wild sheep population and the use of pack goats. Does that, but what I'm hearing about this pathogen is that it can't survive very long outside of the living animal. So how did transmission occur, and when was the Glen Highway, when was that particular part of the Glen Highway construction that you're referring to, when did that occur? And I know there's been a lot of reconstruction of the Glen Highway in the last couple of decades, you know, straightening out and all of that stuff in those same narrow areas that you refer to.
Right. Through the chair, Representative Drummond, I couldn't tell you the exact year. I know that there was a dirt trail by the mid-1930s. Mm-hmm. And I know that it was being traveled regularly, mm-hmm. all the way from the Kinnick River Valley all the way out to McCarthy. So I know that there was a lot of travel back and forth there for supplies. Mm-hmm. The market hunting, just a lot of history books that I've read. Jim Reardon has written some excellent ones, and there are just a lot of individual little photos that I've picked up on over time, you know, where a doll sheep hanging in a spruce tree next to a, you know, next to a camp. I know that along the Richardson Highway, Jim Reardon wrote specifically about individual people that were really, they made a lot of money being just market hunters, and sheep was one of those particular species. And it's my understanding that same effort occurred along the Glen Highway during construction. And given what we know about homesteaders, and most of the lodges had goats, particularly for milk, we know that domestics were spread up and down those dirt roads before they were ever, you know, turned into highways, but at the individual roadhouses and lodges just to provide milk for travelers. So,
the pathogen, how did it live from starting possibly as early as the 30s into the most recent.
So I apologize. So through the chair. So when I referenced that, this is one of the thoughts that we had when we started seeing population declines in other adjacent areas. We thought, well, where could any sort of pathogen transfer have come from? And that was one of our discussions. So you're absolutely right. Several of the respiratory pathogens have to be passed nose to nose or within a couple hundred yards, and Dr. Gerlach can answer some of those pathogenicity questions better than I can. But there are a lot of other respiratory pathogens out there as well that the department is interested in when they do a lot of different testing. So we felt that there was a possibility that some historic transfer could have possibly occurred, but it was just in passing because we didn't have any large-scale die-off. We were trying to specifically identify, you know, what, where, how. So we know that there are a lot of different commonly thrown around terms, such as there's different Pasteurella bacteria, Mannheimias, Bifrostenias, pathogens that are found in pneumonic sheep, and it's come to the attention of biologists in the state over the last decade that a lot of those pathogens are endemic and they're common now in doll sheep populations across the state, including the Talkeetna Mountains. And we felt that perhaps some of those pathogens had come from some of those historic transfers. Now, when you have wild animals in close proximity to homesteads and domestics, it doesn't take much to have a doll sheep come down into a, you know, a yard where you have feed or you have, you know, water troughs or whatnot. So we have photos from Dawson, I think, where we have doll sheep and and domestics in the same pen. And mm-hmm. it just happens in small, remote areas, unfortunately. And those doll sheep have been living with some of those respiratory pathogens for a long time. Mycoplasma ova pneumoniae is a different pathogen. It's been difficult to detect, and testing didn't exist for it years ago. Mm-hmm. So recent testing over the last decade, I would say we'd been testing for doll in doll sheep, at least my understanding is it first started in the Chugach sheep population that we collared in 2008. So at least 10 years we've been sampling the wild populations for MOV and have yet to find any evidence of the pathogen in nasal cavities through nasal swabs or even exposure of it as evidence through a blood serology test looking for titers.
If I may add something to that, I'm used to explaining to businessmen and to senior executives, and so I don't get quite as technical as Becky does. You know, just for, I guess, full disclosure, I graduated from Syracuse as an engineer, so I've had to learn a lot of this stuff myself. But the reality is, I describe it as a 1-2 punch. You heard that basically it creates an immune deficiency. The fancy term is polymicrobial. And I thought the co-chair, Tara, you brought that up in terms of just mycoplasma over pneumonia alone. So what happens is it disarms the cilia in the linings of your airways, and then it allows these other pathogens that you were asking about, which could have been transmitted from domestics way back when, the manhymias and the rest of it. Many of those, during the same blood tests that Becky was describing, have already been found to be in the population. So think of it in generic terms as kindling sitting there waiting for the match, unfortunately. That's why the focus, people will say, is, well, it's polymicrobial, don't focus on one. But the reality is one's already out there, and if we can prevent the match from hitting the kindling, then we got a shot. That's the belief of how it went. And so that's, a little bit more layman than Becky will probably do, but that's how I typically explain it.
Briefly, and then we're going to have to transition to some of the other testimonies, so we'll be able to get to everything today.
Okay.
Representative Drummond.
When you talked about test and cull, are you talking about the wild population or the domestic population?
Through the chair, Representative Drummond, I'm specifically talking about our counterparts with wildlife populations in the western states. It's the wildlife populations that have experienced pneumonic die-offs, and those are the focus of how do we stop it and how do we get those herds healthy again, particular.
And so those two, just real quickly, those two goats that are mentioned in the laboratory analysis, two goats captured on the Kenai also tested positive out of 39 mountain goats analyzed. Were those goats tested and released?
Through the chair, that's my understanding. They were radio collared. Samples are taken, animals released, samples go to the lab. It takes a number of days, sometimes weeks, sometimes longer to get full response on the tests.
So, in other words, if those could have been tested and culled, but the testers would have had to retain the animals somehow, rather than just getting a sample briefly and releasing them.
Right. At this time, the technology that the department is utilizing is standard: draw the blood, send it to the lab in Washington, and have it sampled. Now, there is some newer technology that's being tested out of Washington State University that allows in-the-field testing, but it can take up to 45 minutes to get a result. So there's new technology, and it can't come fast enough.
And then what Mr. Kehoe is talking about, testing the domestic population in Alaska because it's much smaller than the wild population, and the preservation of particular pet animals and so on and so forth, as opposed to destroying them.
Through the chair, Representative Drummond, it's very similar. The reality is cull is one of the options. Mm-hmm. We use the term mitigate because in addition to the cull solution, which would probably have to take place for the wild, with the domestic it would be cull, quarantine, or ship. So you get three options rather than just one. But it's basically, to go MOVI-free, it's the same essential look in both cases.
And one more very short, dumb question. Is the meat of those animals that are culled still edible?
Through the chair, Representative Drummond, absolutely. There's no, it doesn't affect the meat at all.
I belong to the Greek Orthodox Church, which knows how to cook lamb really, really well. So,
Did Representative Rauscher, did you have another question?
Thank you. Through the chair. So once an animal has contacted this disease, how long does it have before it's dead?
Ooh, the million-dollar question. Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, it depends on the strain. It could be as quick as 24 hours. It could take weeks. It could never die. It depends on the strain. It depends on the interaction between the pathogen and the wild animal. In this situation, we're really hoping, best case scenario, we're dealing with a benign strain and nothing happens.
So 10 years ago when we were able to hunt with these animals, any kind of disease that was brought up there would have wiped them all out by now, right?
Oh, through the chair, not necessarily.
You said 24 hours to a couple of weeks, unless it's right. Not going to hurt them. Through the chair.
So, through the chair, Representative Rauscher, the reality is these pathogens come in a lot of different strains. Some are more dangerous than others. So, had we had a very virulent strain of MOV or another pathogen passed 60, 70, 80 years ago, yeah, we would be looking at remnant populations of Dall sheep and mountain goats in those areas had that happened.
That's not the question.
One specific on that. The 5%, the current testing shows that about 4 to 5% of the domestics, that's limited, and Dr. Gerlach can talk to those statistics better than I can, but about of the 400 voluntary tests, only about 4 to 5% came out as positive. So it's entirely possible that, you know, with pack goats or whatever, that group, 5% is a reasonable number, that group wasn't infected. There could be a number of things, and then you get the variables that Becky talked with. So, you know, beyond this is pure speculation, and I'm not sure that answered your question. What was the...
Through the chair, if you're saying that this is an emergency, that these things, that these animals could contact something that could wipe the population out, is what I'm getting, what I'm hearing. Well, 10 years ago, why didn't it wipe the population out if they contracted it? What you're saying is it possible that they could contract it and not wipe it out?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, it is. I think that's what Becky was explaining. We're hoping that it's relatively benign. The problem is, as I pointed out, we have more questions than we have answers right now. So what that says is, you know, there is not emergency that you can absolutely declare because you don't know enough. So I don't want to be accused of being – what it says is you need to get out there, you need to survey, you need to take it aggressively to find out that you don't have a problem. If you wait to see what happens, it could easily get away from you. So it just means to be very proactive in your approach to dealing with it to make sure. In worst case, you'd say, gosh, we overreacted. Well, you overreacted in a way that was the safest way to do it, because if you underreact, it's going to bite us.
Final.
Mm-hmm.
I would just like to make a statement that hunting with pack goats is not mating with wildlife. It's hunting with pack goats. They never touch each other. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess what I heard, and I may have missed it, they tested the goats, and they came up positive in the Kenai area, and then they are collared goats, and then they release them. So, I mean, can't we send a couple fishing game guys out and take those goats before they spread to other population? Wouldn't that be reasonable? Or, I mean, you would think. I mean, if they're collared, that's not exactly hunting. Go find them, right? Or, I mean, what would you think if you found it in a wild population?
So, through the chair, real quick, Representative Johnson, there are differing professional opinions on what you do with an animal that has tested positive for a pathogen like this. If it was up to me, as soon as I found out, I would take a helicopter and I would euthanize those animals immediately, and I would take them out of the population, absolutely. Other professionals sometimes like the wait-and-see approach. Maybe they're immune to it. Maybe it's not a bad strain. Why kill a perfectly healthy-looking animal when nothing has happened? Those are two ends of a very hotly debated discussion right now. So,
follow-up, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. So how would your organization feel about packing a test kit and swabbing animals after they were, as they were hunting? I mean, I know sheep hunters don't like to pack a lot, but
we actually, through the chair, Representative Johnson, we actually advocated for that last year. We offered funds, and it didn't need it because I think the state came up with it. But we sent out through all of our networks to everybody to say, well, you can do that. I was in Fairbanks last night doing a hunting film presentation, and I had a couple of young guys came up to me and said, hey, we took our stuff out there with us and said, I don't know if we did a very good job, but we went and tested and did the swabs to do that. And I'm not sure how the sheep were tested, but they were hunter-killed animals. So there's also a requirement to have them sealed. So whether they were tested in the field by hunters or whether they were actually brought back to Fish and Game, who actually also did it very aggressively at the check stations. So that was put out last year because of our concern, and we intend to emphasize that again this year to be able to do it. So that's how we can work together. So that is a good idea, mm-hmm. and we absolutely support it and want to train guys to really do it, even to the point of potentially incentivizing to say if you come back in and you turn it in, we'll give you a ticket toward a rifle or something else like that to encourage more of it.
Madam Chair, follow-up?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I was wondering, do you have any idea how many, I might have missed it, but how many did you receive? Do you know how many you received from the hunters?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I'll leave that specific question for Director Dale. He can probably answer that. I believe approximately 300 samples were taken between hunter reported kits and animals that were swabbed during the sealing process within the Department of Fish and Game offices.
All right. Very good. Thank you.
Representative Lincoln.
Just real quick, back to the question of taking the infected animals out of the population. Is that something that Fish and Game or another agency has the authority to do now? Is it just sort of a decision that they need to make, or do they need any sort of statute or regulatory change to be able to do that if they decide that's the best thing?
Through the chair, I would leave that question for Director Dale.
Okay.
She said.
Thank you so much. Obviously a very, good and interesting and timely topic for us. Before we go to the few public testimony and just for our schedule here, we're aiming to also hear 3:15, at least the introductory piece of it. I don't really see public testimony lined up for that, with the exception, it looks like, of a couple people. So we want to do that and then still be able to get introduction of 260 today. So we're going to have to kind of scoot through things to keep moving. So, Mr. Dale, if you could be available here to see if there are any questions. And I guess what I just wanted to have you talk a little bit about was the test results that just came back and the statement that I made earlier. Had received an email. They said they reported that the strain detected has not been tied to the genetic strain found in domestic animals. We simply do not know where or when the wild animals may have been exposed. And as the previous speaker was saying, that, you know, some of this could be historical. And could you just, from the Fish and Game, you know, having conducted this and sent out the results, give us an update on that?
Yes. Madam Chair, this is Bruce Dale from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and the Director of the Division of Wildlife Conservation. You're correct in that we haven't completed the work with the laboratory on the identification of the strain that was found in either the wild goats or the wild sheep. That work is ongoing. It requires looking at additional genes to match it up and compare it with known samples in the gene bank.
And so, Mr. Dale, at this time, some of the suggestions, you know, in conversation you heard was, should these animals be removed from the wild population? From the press release, it looks like the sheep that were tested and found positive had been harvested by individuals and appeared to be healthy. So, you know, are you taking the wait-and-see approach, or the need more information, or are you considering the calling of animals from wild populations once the results are positive?
Oh, thank you for the question. Bruce Dale. The samples from the sheep, those positive sheep were healthy. They appeared healthy in every respect to the people that harvested them and brought them in. In that population, we're waiting to see, we're waiting to develop a monitoring plan for that population. We're trying to decide whether we go out and collar them. There's some chance that you might, if you handle animals that are have a bacteria or something, that actually handling them and then handling other animals afterwards could spread it. So we're looking to see if we identify the strains, and then we're going to develop a monitoring plan. Plus, as Ms. Schwanke stated, we have additional samples that have not yet been run, so we might find that it's a larger area that we have to work with, and so any kind of monitoring plan for the sheep needs to be based on that area. We have collected samples from large parts of the state that haven't been positive. With the goats, those goats are radio collared, so we're able to monitor their health carefully. Remember, that's in terms of culling those animals, that's two positive goats, three more that still need additional testing that are possibles, but two out of 39. So that tells us that there's very likely many other goats that are positive on the Kenai. And removing two of them, when they can tell us whether or not they're going to get sick or not as part of that sample, and removing them and not removing the bacteria from the population, it seems like those goats are more valuable on site right now, so we can monitor their health and determine how extreme of a reaction we should have to these animals. Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Dale? Representative Lincoln.
So I don't want my comments to be misconstrued in terms of being in favor of taking a position on whether to cull them or not. I just want to make sure that you feel like you have, you know, the authority to make the best decision in your mind. Well, you know, what how to address the, you know, finding this in the wild population. Do you feel like you got all the tools you need to address it?
Through the chair, we wish we had more tools, certainly. But of the known tools, we have those tools in our toolbox. And we have good aggressive screening going on of the samples we've collected. We have collected hundreds of samples. And so we've done a good job over the last couple of years, especially the last year, of getting out there and trying to screen as much as we can for this and other diseases. We've been monitoring diseases for a long, long time with the department. It's part of what we do. We're also monitoring other issues such as winter tick and chronic wasting disease, which would both be really catastrophic as well to moose populations or caribou populations. And, of course, in terms of being able to handle animals, we probably have a more extensive program, despite our lack of roads, than most states do. So we can handle them. We can call them. I believe we have the tools, if I've answered your question.
Okay, then let's go to the public testimony. First, I have Mr. Paul Finch from North Pole. Mr. Finch, are you available?
Hello, it's my turn.
Yes, and for public testimony, we're limited to 2 minutes per person, and then they'll, if there are any questions from committee members. So please state your name and affiliation for the record, and please provide your testimony.
Okay, my name is Paul Finch, and I am the agent on North Country Farm on Eielson Farm Road, and have a herd of 4 meat goats, and that reproduces to about 70 animals every summer, which are marketed for their meat. And I would just like to read a quick statement and maybe take questions. I'd like to say that just please be aware that HCR 23 is a complex issue. It is actually putting small farms with goats and sheep in Alaska at economic, legal, and emotional risk that potentially may not be survivable. interpolated irrelevant theoretical data from the lower 48 is used to fuel the premise behind this bill. Just please allow appropriate input from farmers in this hunter-sponsored legislation with a common-sense solution protecting all parties. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Finch. Any questions?
Just a quick one.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mr. Finch, the Mountain West die-off, is it your suggestion that that is not MOVI related?
That's not what I said. The issue is the grazing habits in the lower 48 have no bearing on the Alaskan picture. And there are many barriers between the domestic and wild population that will never be overcome. And so there, the initial proposals from WSF and some others were overreaching shock statements designed to produce results. And to me, it is worrisome that this is a unidirectional stepping stone toward unreasonable mitigation measures.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for your testimony, sir. What would you view as a reasonable solution?
Well, there are various goat groups in the state that have proposed very reasonable stepwise solutions, which would take too much time, and I don't have all of those handy. Basically, the risk needs to be stratified and applied in an appropriate geographical measure. Nobody wants to hurt the wild population. Nobody. Not even the goat people, but to impose draconian measures on a herd that will never see wild sheep habitat, and the closest they will come is in frozen packages in the freezer, is just not appropriate. It's just more time and more input from these groups need to happen.
Okay. I'm going to keep going. We appreciate it, Mr. Finch, and I'm a big supporter of farmers, and so I'm going to be thinking about those angles as we consider this. Next person we have is Tiana Thomas. Ms. Thomas, if you could please state your name and any affiliation for the record and then provide your testimony. Again, 2 minutes per person.
Hi. I am with the Mutual Aid Network of Livestock Owners and Producers. And we are very concerned with House Bill or Resolution 23. It is the first log on the fire of trying to boil the frog to death. It would be an ineffective, costly, and crippling blow against food security and food access in the state. The science says that asymptomatic sheep, which the 3% of domestics in the state that it was discovered in are asymptomatic. They cannot spread it past 1 foot because they are not symptomatic. They are not coughing. They do not have runny snot. They cannot broadcast it into the air. The also the goat variant, which is likely what the Unit 13A goats were exposed to many years ago, it is not fatal, as the sheep variant is fatal, especially when you have in the states a commingled commercial size herd going into habitat. We do not have that, and we do not have transplanted animals that have lost their historic travel patterns and are more likely to interact with domestics. These quotes on science are conveniently ignoring studies that say that pack horses are as lethal as pack goats with a different bacterium. And in to demand that the state be MOVI-free is a scientific impossibility, as you'll probably hear from the veterinarian, you cannot prove that it won't exist. And in fact, the Wild Sheep Foundation has stated that they will not allow an animal to be proved negative if they have tested positive once on serology, which means that they have had it and beaten it off and are no longer carrying it. If they're not culturing it in the nasal passage, they just have a antibody remnant in their blood, they are no longer a transmitter or a carrier. They will not allow that animal to be proven negative, no matter how many negative nasal swabs they have. And the science, current science, states that a positive nasal swab does not indicate the presence of infection. Detection is not infection. And that that same animal, in subsequent tests, many tests will come up negative. They can clear the mycoplasma. Detection is not infection. Infection is not lethal in every case. It does not mean what they say it means. They conveniently edit their science for the worst possible outcome.
Ms. Thomas.
And also ignore our solutions for culling via isolation rather than culling via euthanization.
Thank you. I was just going to say I had to cut you off because we were just a little over 3 minutes there, and we are so pressed for time. Thank you for your testimony. And you just mentioned here at the end other solutions. If you want to send that information along to the committee, we'd be happy to provide that to all members. Question from Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, ma'am, for your testimony. Do you know what proportion of your constituent membership's flocks are tested, herds, rather?
Yes, a large number. I would say probably 80% of our membership has had, through the voluntary testing, their flocks cleared. And then the rest have about 3% of the sheep are asymptomatic detection, and 1% of the goats. And again, the goat strain is not as lethal as the sheep strain. So goat contact is not a concern. 1% is not a concern. It's actually a statistical anomaly. It could be a false positive.
Thank you.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you.
Chair, really quick question, Ms. Thomas. You said that you were with the Mutual Aid Network of Livestock Producers. Is that livestock producers in Alaska, and are you located in Alaska? And if so, where, please?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question, ma'am. Yes, I am located in Alaska. We are in Unit 14. Mm-hmm. I was born in Juneau, and we moved to this region in 85, and we have been involved with livestock ever since.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Thomas.
You're welcome.
We'll look forward to getting that information from you. Next, we have...
Where should I send it?
House Resources at akledge.gov. I think that's right. House Resources at akledge.gov.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Next, we have Ms. Amy Seitz from the Alaska Farm Bureau.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Co-Chairs Tarr and Josephson, for hearing this resolution today. For the record, my name is Amy Seitz, Executive Director for the Alaska Farm Bureau. And while the Alaska Farm Bureau agrees with the intent of this resolution, to encourage our agencies to protect the health of our wildlife and domestic animals, we do want to stress one whereas in particular, and that is on the first page, line 13. The state subscribes to science-based wildlife management. This is a key point in having effective management practices in place, and we do want to make sure that the science used for managing our resources is relevant to Alaska. If agencies are encouraged to implement measures based on situations or information pertinent in other states, this is not necessarily prudent. In working with agencies on the current issue we're facing right now regarding domestic and wild sheep and goat interaction and MOV, the agencies are doing what this resolution encourages. They are gathering the information necessary to base a decision on science, and that science relevant to Alaska and our doll sheep population. Taking this action as opposed to implementing a solution before we have the facts is the necessary and prudent route to take. And instead of passing a resolution that would encourage our agencies to take these steps. The legislature could actually show encouragement and support of our agencies in their efforts by doing things like enacting the bill we're going to hear about next. Doing things like that would encourage people to test their animals so our agency would know what diseases are out there. It would help with early detection, and it would give agencies time to respond appropriately. So while the intent of this resolution is fine, the Alaska Farm Bureau just believes that there would be other ways the legislature could show their support for agencies.
Is that the end of your testimony?
Yes, I was trying to get it within the 2 minutes.
You did great. Thank you so much. Any questions for Ms. Seitz? And I think you're going to stay on for the next bill, too, so we'll be able to talk about your suggestion in that context. Yes. Okay. Then I'm going to go to our last public testifier here, John Sturgeon. If you could please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Yes, my name is John Sturgeon. Today I'm representing the Alaska Outdoor Council. It's an organization that has about 10,000 members. It's an umbrella organization that works on wildlife and fisheries type issues. My testimony will be very quick. I support the Alaska Outdoor Council supports the efforts of the Wild Sheep Foundation. We'd also like to thank Representative Josephson for introducing resolution number 23. We think it's a very good step to help solve a potentially very, very devastating problem for Alaska's wild sheep and goat and muskox. I would also like to stress that the value of wildlife in Alaska, not only for hunting, but for viewing, it's an incredible resource for Alaska, one of the only state that has dall sheep, and it's a treasure that we should make sure that it stays healthy and nothing happens in the future. I guess I'd like to, just two quick points is that in the lower 48, where they have domestic wildlife, domestic animals, it's not unusual to require testing and to make sure these animals are disease-free. When they go to a state fair or they're sold, especially horses, they're required to have testing and make sure they're disease-free. So it's not something that's unusual that expect domestic animals to be free from disease that could affect other animals and affect the wildlife population. And also, I guess I'd like to stress is that I go hunting every year down in Montana and Wyoming, have for the last 25 years, and I hear a lot about what's happened to the sheep populations down there. And there have been entire populations of sheep in mountain ranges. There, 70 to 80% of the sheep have been killed by MOVI. It's a very deadly disease and one that should not be underestimated. And it's one that kind of lurks in the background until the conditions are right. And then it gives a kind of double whammy. Another pathogen comes in, and the sheep, the wild sheep, die in large numbers. And I guess my last point is that one of the representatives, committee members, asked for a solution from domestic folks. I've been going with Kevin Kehoe from Wild Sheep Foundation for the last year up in Palmer, and that's a question we keep asking. Give us a solution. We don't want. I think everybody wants to make sure that we don't have this pathogen enter the wild sheep population. And what the Wild Sheep Foundation has proposed, I think, is very generous. They're offering to pay for it at no expense to the domestic folks. So again, I think this is a very good resolution, and I'd like to thank Representative Josephson again for introducing it. And thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Sturgeon? Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony on this right now. If we need to reopen it, we will do that at a future time. And quickly, could we have folks come up, and we're going to transition right into House Bill 315. And there was a request. Dr. Gerlich, as you begin your presentation, there's a request that you could answer the question. And I'm sorry I hadn't had time to review your presentation. Maybe you do address this, but is it a realistic goal or, you know, realistic that we could accomplish this to have the state be free of this bacteria?
Representative Tarr, I would say that the total elimination of a disease is extremely difficult. The world has only accomplished two diseases that have been completely eliminated. One is cattle rinderpest, and the other is smallpox. So that you look at very very difficult time to do that. And rinderpest was identified as cattle fever back in the, I want to say, 1700s. And it was the reason why most veterinary schools were formed to address that. And it's taken us just up until a couple of years ago to eliminate that. So I would say to go ahead and totally eliminate a pathogen is an extremely large task and very costly.
Thank you. And what I'm going to do because of the time is not do any questions till the end of your presentation. And I'm hoping that you would be able to do it in about 10 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, perfect.
Good afternoon. My name is Christina Carpenter, and I'm the director for the Division of Environmental Health in the Department of Environmental Conservation. And, of course, this is Dr. Robert Gerlach, the state veterinarian. Today we're here to talk to you about House Bill 315, which would keep certain records held by both DEC and DNR confidential and not subject to disclosure. We would continue to release general information that is found in our records, but it would prohibit us from being responsible for releasing records that may contain personally identifying information. It would also allow us to disclose information from our records if there was a threat or to the public. And we compare this a lot to some of the other protections that's already provided to other commercial industries. So, for example, commercial fisheries is a good example. Fish and Game has a clause in their statutes that allows them to keep certain information reported by commercial fishermen exempt from disclosure. So things like fishing holes. Fish and Game obviously needs that information so that they can properly manage commercial fisheries. Commercial fishermen wouldn't like that subject to public disclosure because that's, you know, proprietary business information. That's how they make a living. So we're trying to give that similar confidentiality to our Alaskan agricultural producers. And this House Bill 315, the concept of it, has actually something that's been discussed between DEC, DNR, and our Alaskan agricultural producers for at least the last 10 years. I have heard that this bill is being called HIPAA for horses in these halls, and we think that that's appropriate because that is our intention. And it's even more timely now given the recent MOVI discussion. And why it's appropriate is because House Bill 315 is mutually beneficial for state agencies as well as the individual producers. We believe that animal owners and crop producers will be more willing to participate in voluntary surveillance sampling programs with DEC and DNR if they know that the results of that information or the results of those tests are not subject to public disclosure. So when this MOVI discussion came up about 18 or 24 months ago, when Dr. Bob was trying to set up this MOVI study in domestic sheep and goat populations, a lot of our Alaskan domestic or livestock owners were very reluctant to participate in the study because they knew that it would be subject to disclosure. The test results would be subject to disclosure if our office was in possession of them. And the benefit that the state gets with the passing of 315 is that we get additional information on emerging threats and disease outbreaks so that we can work with our peers and the other resource agencies to properly manage Alaska's resources. And I included this slide to show you the difference between a record versus information, and what we're trying to do with this. The Office of the State Veterinarian is not looking to withhold information from public consumption, but we are trying to protect the records that we have on file. So this is an example of a record that is currently subject to disclosure. It has personal information like a name, address, phone number, specific destination information, and test results, as well as identifying animal ear tag information, potentially. So right now, if we were FOIA'd, we would have to give out this record without redacting it. Under 315, we would still share information for the public, but it would be in a more generalized and anonymous format. So we would say, in late December, there were 9 reindeer transported by air from Alaska to Texas, and they came from a herd that was confirmed to be chronic wasting disease free. These are a few more examples. In the event of an animal cruelty investigation, we would release the records or the information from our records that would help aid law enforcement officials in their investigation. But if there was a disease information that required public outreach, such as rabies, we would coordinate with our peers in the Department of Health and Social Services and Fish and Game, as well as the local public health and veterinary officials, so that they could increase public outreach and awareness, so that everybody was looking for, rabies symptoms, maybe in domestic and wild flocks. So House Bill 315, as I'd mentioned, we believe that it will encourage better animal husbandry because those animal owners will be engaging in our office. They'll be participating in those surveillance sampling, which is non-mandatory sampling, which will they can then use as a marketing tool for their Alaskan agriculture products. It would also allow for that early identification and reaction if there is an emerging outbreak or threat that the public health and animal health officials in the state need to deal with. And it would also protect proprietary information from disclosure to a competitor. What it won't do is keep DEC or DNR from releasing general information that the public needs to know if there is a public health threat. It also will not hamper our efforts to control that disease and outbreak to mitigate that threat. And it won't limit law enforcement agencies and their animal cruelty investigations. This is a quick sectional analysis. As you can see, it's a really short bill, and the meat of it is in Section 1, where it makes, again, certain records held by DEC and DNR exempt from the Public Records Act if they meet certain criteria. But it still allows those departments to release information if there is a public health threat. So with that, any questions?
Representative Rauscher was the first question, then I see Representative Drummond, and then Parrish.
Yeah. Through the chair, thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. I guess I would like to say that I could probably understand what you're trying to convey here with people hesitant to declare or have their animals tested because of what happened here earlier. You know, I mentioned the fact that I had animals that I had taken up in the wild, and right away I was, you know, singled out as possibly the reason that some of these goats may have had an infection. So I guess what I'm saying here, I guess I can see where you're saying that people would be less hesitant to come forward if this bill was to actually be passed. So I just thought I'd make that statement.
Thank you, Representative Rauscher. Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm slightly confused. On page 5 of this slide, you're talking about the example of release of information, a zoonotic disease outbreak, which is a disease that can be transmitted from animals to humans. That's not the only kind of information we're talking about releasing. This is just specifically an infectious disease that could impact humans. Or are you also referring to diseases like the pathogen that we addressed regarding the wild sheep and goats?
Through the chair, Representative Drummond, that's correct. We would release any sort of information related to a disease outbreak that is zoonotic or maybe transmittable, but transmittable through domestic or wildlife herds. Rabies is a good example because it can impact domestic, livestock, and humans. And so depending on the threat that we're dealing with, it would depend on the outreach with our information that we would give. So for the rabies example, we would want to involve public health and the Department of Fish and Game. With the MOVI issue, it's not transmittable to humans, mm-hmm. So we wouldn't have any reason to release that information to our peers in public health.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I see. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do appreciate the specificity of the presentation. Looking at the bill itself here on page 2, section or subsection B, notwithstanding A of the section or any other provision of law, the Department of Environmental Conservation and DNR may disclose any records that are subject to the section if the Department of Environmental Conservation or the Department of Natural Resources determines that there is a threat to the health or safety of an animal, a crop, or the public. Just on the plain reading of it, it would seem that if there were any occasion in which any animal were diseased, it would be at the discretion of DEC and DNR whether or not to release the full records. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, that is accurate.
Thank you. And in response to the earlier remark, I do apologize. It's vanishingly unlikely that any of the representatives' animals were involved or were implicated.
No worries.
Okay. Thank you so much. We're going to go into public testimony here because we have people stacked up, and we're going to have to try and move quickly through the public testimony. So I'm going to go to the folks that were online first. So Dr. Marianne Hollick of Eagle River. Dr. Hollick, if you could please state your name and any affiliation for the record and then provide your testimony. And I'm going to have to do the hard two-minute cutoff for testimony at this time.
Absolutely. I'll be brief. My name is Dr. Marianne Hollick. I'm from Eagle River, Alaska. I'm an Alaskan veterinarian who's been in private practice for the past 30 years. I also represent Alaska's veterinarians to the American Veterinary Medical Association, but I am speaking in private capacity at this point. I support House Bill 315 as it represents an individual's medical privacy. Currently, animal owners have been required to disclose certain diagnostic test results to be in compliance with state rules. These results are currently public records. If owners know these records are available for all to see, they very well may be reluctant to have their animals tested voluntarily for contagious diseases. Also, where the owners and the animal live should not be public knowledge. Early detection is the key to controlling serious widespread outbreaks, and they could jeopardize animal and public health. These same test results are private in other states. Finally, if there is a credible threat, the state veterinarian will disclose relevant information and act to ensure animal and public safety. And I would also like to say I have known the state veterinarian, Dr. Robert Gerlach, for over 30 years. He has been in private practice before he became a state veterinarian, and he is very well respected in the entire veterinary community. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Dr. Hollick? Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Doctor, for your testimony. What diseases are you not required to forward to the state veterinarian?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, through the chair, we're not required to report diseases such as parvovirus. That's a common small animal disease that is not a reportable disease.
I apologize. I couldn't hear your last sentence very well.
That is not a reportable disease.
Thank you, ma'am.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, Dr. Pollack. I was having a very hard time hearing you. Are you in support of House Bill 315 or against it?
I am in support of House Bill 315.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, next we're going to go, and now these are all folks we have heard from, so if people can keep the comments brief. Ms. Tiana Thomas? Please state your name for the record and please provide your testimony. Okay, I'm going to go to John Anderson, and we can come back to Ms. Thomas if she's available. John Anderson, could you please state your name for the record and any affiliation, provide your testimony?
Yes, through the Madam Chair. My name is John Anderson. I am representing myself today. House Bill 315, I think there's some very good parts to it, and there's also possibly what I would call some questionable parts. And what I like about the bill, I'll just start off with that, is the testing requirements right now. I know you heard about the sheep and goat issue. So, you know, having farmers not worried about testing so that they can get more animals tested is absolutely a good thing. But I have an issue with the import side of the bill. I've been going through the state vet's office now for almost 2 years on receiving import records when it was brought to my attention that there's been a lot of issues with animals being imported and being sold as either local, Alaska grown, fresh from, you know, Palm or Alaska, let's say, and, or, you know, fresh from Fairbanks. And there was a lot of misrepresentation of the animal importation. But when I dealt with the Division of Ag, and my issue with the animal import is there's no checks and balances. I've dealt with the Division of Ag. I've brought many of these issues to them, and their answer is, well, we don't have a budget to check. Even though in the Alaska Grown statute, or in the paperwork that you sign up when you become an Alaska Grown member, it says the Division of Ag could come out to your farm at any time. So there's just... there's no checks and balances. The Division of Ag is not checking Alaska Grown accountability through the State Vet's Office on importing. I personally have done that because I would like to protect our farm. I'd like to protect, you know, our marketing, our availability of saying, you know, we're out there in 50 below for farrowing pigs or calving or cows, and we're doing all this stuff, and then these people could bring in animals and they can, you know, slip them in as Alaska Grown and trying to get a premium. You know, you just heard House Bill 217, product preference. So who's protecting the product preference? Mm-hmm. Would be Alaska Grown. Technically, it should be the Division of Ag. And
Mr.
now,
Anderson, I'm sorry, you're
import.
Mr. Anderson, you're at 2 minutes and 35 seconds, so I have to ask you to wrap up.
Okay, I just would ask that that you would look at the import record, and the import records are actually federally, you can find them from the USDA and get all the same information. I've gotten them from the State Vet's Office and the USDA, and there's no difference in the information. So this bill, while, like I said, I respect to testing port, the import records, I think it's not going to help because records could be found elsewhere.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for your time.
And I just want to ask Ms. Carpenter for a point of clarity. I don't think the import issue is addressed in this piece of legislation. Could you clarify that?
Yes. For the record, this is Christina Carpenter again. And this bill does allow us to keep animal or crop importation records confidential that identify a particular animal, crop, business, or an individual. And I'm sensitive to Mr. Anderson's concerns. From DEC's perspective, our mission is to make sure that those animals that are imported into the state of Alaska are healthy and disease-free. And if there's a marketing aspect issue, that would need to be answered to by DNR. And the reason that we would want to keep those animal importation records subject to our confidentiality clause is because that includes the name and the physical address and the location where those animals are going to. And it also includes where those animals are coming from. And that could be considered private business or proprietary information that that's part of what we're looking to do is keep people's business information private. Mm-hmm. I had another thought and I lost it, but that's our intent with this is to protect our agriculture producers so that they can grow their business.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Carpenter. And I need to apologize to Mr. Anderson. I misspoke and we're going to go continue on with the public testimony because of where we're at in the time, but I wanted her to give that point of clarity. But what this isn't addressing is the misbranding, and that is actually in a different section of statute as it relates to Alaska Grown. There are specific provisions about misbranding, and that is where I think we want to look at that, and that came up with House Bill 217. So that, I apologize, that's what I was thinking and not said out loud. Representative Parrish, do you have a real quick question?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. And this is something that Mr. Anderson said. Mr. Anderson, was it correct that the USDA is already furnishing the information about animal crop importation records with the things that we're trying to protect with this legislation?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, that is correct. I have used the Freedom of Information Act to go through the state vet's office as well as the USDA, and I have those documents. You can look at the same animals, at the same truckloads of animals from one permit paperwork has and this permit paperwork from the USDA. And you can compare them. It has same information other than maybe one or two lines, but it's all right there. And I'd be happy to send that to your office, Representative Parrish.
A quick follow-up.
Quick.
Is there any difference in the ease or cost of accessing that information between the state and the feds?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, at this time there's no cost to either. It actually provides those documents faster than the federal, than the USDA. The USDA takes about a month, sometimes less, sometimes more. The state is about a 10-day working day deadline.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. We're going to go on to Ms. Seitz from the Farm Bureau.
Well, hello again. Co-Chairs Tarr, Josephson, and the rest of the Resource Committee. For the record, my name is Amy Seitz. I am the Executive Director for the Alaska Farm Bureau, and I am here to speak in support of House Bill 315. Allowing confidentiality of certain personal and business records for our farmers will afford them some security in their business, as well as helping us keep our ag sector healthy. In order to comply with state and federal laws, farmers have to provide certain information to DEC or DNR. There are also situations where a farmer may be required to submit test results or want to participate in a voluntary surveillance program. records that DEC and DNR maintain can be specific to particular animals, crops, information on our farmers' businesses, and specific results from testing. Under current law, these records are not protected. We want our farmers to feel comfortable working with state agencies in maintaining health of animals and crops. Knowing that someone can access specifics on these results, who tested, where they're located, what the test results were, does not afford securities to our farmers, and it does not encourage participation in these testing programs. Having more farmers participating in testing could help us produce a higher quality product and increase efficiencies in production. It could also help with early detection of a possible outbreak or concern, which would give agencies time to respond appropriately. And then also, since it does cover import information, you know, general information on imports or general information on testing will still be available if this bill passes. This should be sufficient information to let people know what's happening in the state. And there are steps a person can take if they do have a concern, whether it's misuse of the Alaska Grown logo or concerns that there's a possible disease or pathogen, and maybe they don't think the appropriate steps are being taken to mitigate whatever those concerns are. So again, we support House Bill 315. We think that it's important to protect our farmers' personal and business information, and we believe there are steps a person could take if they don't think agencies are doing their due diligence.
Thank you, Ms. Seitz. Appreciate your testimony. Any questions?
Oh, wait.
Okay. And so the last two folks we have here in the room, Mr. Kehoe and Ms. Schwenke, did I get it right this time? If you two could please come forward. And again, have to hold to the firm two-minute deadline because we still have one item of business we're trying to get to in the next about 7 minutes.
For the record, my name is Kevin Kehoe. I'm president of the Alaska Wild Sheep Foundation. I appreciate the chance to testify here. We generally support keeping personal information private, but we also think that testing records should remain public. So trying to weigh those two is probably one of the biggest challenges that we have out here. I'll turn to Becky here, who has some more specific questions on access to, for instance, testing records.
Thank you.
Thank you, co-chairs, and I'm sorry, Josephson, I was going to say it wrong. Again, my name is Rebecca Schwanke. I'm here as a staff biologist with the Alaska Wild Sheep Foundation. Very quickly, honestly, I believe this bill is very vague, and it concerns me from a biological perspective. We've already covered MOVI, its history, its possible impacts on Alaska's doll sheep and goats, but it also covers pathogens and diseases that it can affect any number of Alaskan wildlife species. So it's much bigger than MOVI. To fully understand the current state of pathogens, parasites, viruses, and other diseases that may be detrimental to wildlife in Alaska, it will be critical to have access to all available test and import records. The components of this bill that concern me focus on the confidentiality of individual and specific test results. Given general information, which DEC says that they will release, is not good enough for independent scientific community members, and it's really not fair to domestic owners that wish to know what pathogens or diseases are present in the state. In MOVI outbreaks in the western states, understanding the strains are critical to understanding what we're dealing with and where it came from. Understanding the pathways of disease is important, and it's critical for mitigating and controlling disease. I'm far more concerned with maintaining open access to what comes in the state through imports and what's already in the state as known from testing records than any individual names or personal information. As Representative Rauscher mentioned with his pack goats, I believe the vast majority of our domestic owners are they are responsible, and they don't let their animals come in contact with wild sheep and goats, and I'm extremely grateful for the ethics displayed by those owners. Unfortunately, not every owner is as responsible. Some animals escape farms. Some have been allowed to openly graze when they're in the mountains. There's photos everywhere. The reason testing and importation records must remain publicly accessible is in the case that we see a conflict, or we see a novel pathogen show up in the state. And sometimes we may only know that through import records or testing that the state does. The geographic locations, or at least the specific regions, must be public information when it comes to understanding any possible threat to wildlife or other domestic owners. In no way do we want to jeopardize...
To wrap up.
Yep, I'm done. Individuals with these comments, but there are larger concerns when it comes to protecting Alaskan wildlife. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the testifiers? Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and through the Chair. On page 2, lines 10 and 11 of the bill, it says that the DEC and DNR can disclose any records if there's a threat to the health or safety of an animal, a crop, or the public. In the case of any positive test results for disease, would you argue that there exists such a threat, and do you believe that if it came to a court case that you would prevail?
Our belief, that's one of our concerns. We would hope that there'd be a rewrite so that we could actually get behind this, but as it stands currently, you've heard a debate on is it a threat, is it not a threat. So there'd come a time when simply any information would be blocked from any information simply because someone said, no, we don't think it's a threat. And then it would revolve in a court case and the rest of it. That's one of our concerns. We think threat should be defined very clearly in statute so that we agree. Is, in this case, a MOVI a threat? Is it not? Otherwise, that information could be blocked and probably would be blocked from us.
Yeah. Final.
Follow-up.
Thank you. I'd just like to invite you and the DEC staff to work with me in my office to try to figure out what language would answer your concern. And if you have any suggestion for that you want to put on record now, happy to hear it.
Right. Through the chair, Representative Parrish, we've submitted some language and some concepts on doing that. We believe that this could be common ground for us, and we'd like to work with trying to proceed through this. And so we're happy to work with anyone on sitting down and trying to resolve those issues to get to the point where not only us but the other supporting groups or sportsmen's groups that support us would also be comfortable with this particular language.
Thank you. We did have Arthur Keyes, Bruce Dale, and Jennifer Curie. She's with Department of Law. Bruce, of course, Director of the Division of Wildlife Conservation, and then Arthur, Director of Division of Agriculture. Did any of you plan on providing public testimony, or were you just available for questions?
Hello?
Chair
Tarr, I'm just here for questions. This is Arthur Keyes, Director of the Division of Agriculture, and I was just here to answer any questions that anyone may have.
Okay. Does anyone have any questions for Mr. Keyes? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good to talk to you, Art. I guess I think you've probably heard all the variety of testimony and so on. I just wanted to hear what the division's position is, and if you have any, is there anything in this bill that you can, you know, that you have any concerns with, or anything else you might want to add?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, yeah, I support House Bill 315, the confidentiality in ag. There is potential for the information that I think the Division of Ag has a need to collect when working with farmers. I think there's a need to keep that information confidential. I also, you know, from I've heard on the wild sheep and goat side of things, ultimately information's important, information gathering is important. And without this confidentiality, you know, as that doctor of veterinary medicine said earlier, without this confidence that there'll be the information will be kept confidential, I think you're going to have trouble gathering the information, the very information you need to make informed decisions. So I think that's about all I would have to add for that. I do support HB 315.
Any follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I hope, you know, if there's a way to facilitate this in any way where we can bring both sides to an agreement and come up with what will work for both groups, I think that would be ideal if at all possible. So, and I'm sure you'd be willing to work on that.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. And I'm going to close public testimony. And what we're planning to do with these two bills, the House Concurrent Resolution 23 and House Bill 2315, is hold them until next Wednesday to be the next hearings. We would ask for amendments by Tuesday at 10 a.m. so we could distribute those to members. Of course, nothing set in stone. Obviously, a lot of interest in this topic and some concerns on all sides. So I want to make sure we get it right with our work. But that's our plan at this time, to try to kind of keep things moving along. So that's what's happening with those at this time. Our last item of business was House Bill 260. We do have this scheduled again for next Wednesday, and we have about 1 minute. And so at least if we can get it introduced today, then that sets us up better for the work next week. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Representative Dan Sadler, House District 13, and sponsor of House Bill 260. Not sure if you need to formally introduce it, but...
Nope.
Very good. Well, Madam Chair, thank you. If there's one thing I can do is talk fast, and I can make it a minute. I appreciate you hearing this, members of the committee. Smartphones, we all have them. They're an indispensable part of our modern life. It's convenient, inexpensive. It gives us communication, navigation, scheduling, entertainment, photography, research. There's nothing that we don't do that we don't rely on these things. I couldn't live without it. My Bill 260 seeks to leverage this communications technology to enhance the timeless pleasures of traditional Alaskan activity, hunting, fishing, trapping, by letting us keep state licenses on our phones as well as being on your paper license. State law requires outdoorsmen to carry their paper license with them while they enjoy those licensed activities. But if you've ever fallen in the river, if you've ever been in a rainy duck blind, you know that paper licenses will fall apart at the worst possible time when the wildlife trooper is approaching you saying, "Sir, madam, do you have a license? I know it's here someplace." But your phone is always with you, right? And since 2013, Alaskans have been able and authorized under law to display their auto insurance coverage by digital devices, and that's working well. I think we could extend that capability to fishing licenses as well. This would have several beneficial effects. It would let hunters and fishers and trappers make it easier to obtain and carry their licenses. It would help entice new entrants into these activities by lowering a barrier to entry. It would make Alaska a more attractive and enjoyable tourist destination because they could get these licenses online on the ship before they pulled in, and it would be much easier for them to go get a non-resident license and experience Alaska fishing. It would improve compliance with state fish and game laws by making it easier for enforcement agents to verify that users are legal, and it could save the state money by providing less cost for processing paper, and would save supplies and equipment. It also, the bill lays out the foundation for smartphone-based applications that I hope eventually will let the Department of Fish and Game deliver information to fishermen on regulations, on openings and closings and hazards, while letting outdoorsmen reciprocate by sharing information on harvest and conditions back with the department. Until then, though, the benefits of this law are significant enough that I feel they deserve swift approval of House Bill 260. I appreciate you letting me introduce it, and await your pleasure.
Thank you. We really do have to exit the room because the other group is supposed to be starting right now. We did public notice, public testimony, and Mr. Mark Richard of Resident Hunters of Alaska, if you are unavailable next Wednesday, can you provide your public testimony right now?
I sure can, Madam Chair. This is Mark Richard with Resident Hunters of Alaska. I'll be very brief. We're in full support. House Bill 260, we think it's basically a no-brainer. As Representative Sadler just said, many of us have our smartphones. We have them waterproofed. Our license gets wet. This is just would help all around. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Richard was the only individual signed up for public testimony, so I should have opened it officially, and now I will close it. And we will bring this bill back before the committee on Wednesday. If you, again, have any amendments for any of the bills up Wednesday, please turn them in by 10 a.m. We are adjourned at 3:16.